Welcome back to Tome of Tales. Set in the Cantus Expanse, a long-running 5th edition D&D campaign, this episode is a downtime write-up called Salyisuli Verenal. Cheryl had been spending much of her time helping Bane, and by extension, Varys, organize the possessions left behind in the soldiers' quarters in the Crimson Fist compound. Some were sent back to their families, others merely tossed, their value gone with a person who was no longer there. A few of the things were donated to Thea's refuge. Bane had worked very efficiently, clearly not wanting to waste time or dwell on things. As a result, Cheryl was sharing more meals with them. These were prepared by Grits, though not the exquisite fare she would have had at the Four Fair Winds. Some became her favorite. Once the plates were cleared, she would pull out her harp to play a song, or a few, and though none of them ever said it to her, she could feel a light starting to warm the cold stone halls for all of them. She was also able to glean what happened to Sunday. The tiefling paladin had set off with Varys, Bane, Taffeta, and Peony, but it became clear very quickly that she had not come back. Cheryl had thought the worst, until Varys told her what happened. In a desperate bid to kill Zariel, Sunday had called upon Corallon. The protector and preserver of life had appeared in the first stopping time. They asked what it was Sunday wished of them, and she had asked for them to kill Zariel. "There will be a cost, even for me," they had cautioned, but Sunday had said it was what they needed of them. Corallon then summoned a mighty tree, burning even as it grew, its branches obliterating Zariel's lieutenants and striking the Archduchess herself to the ground. As quick as it had come, the tree vanished, and Corallon, mighty creator of elves and first of the Seldarin, collapsed into Sunday's arms. Then, without a word to the others, Sunday, Corallon, and her winged companion, Elk, vanished from Avernus. Cheryl saw Marcus a few days after hearing this story, after a long day of helping at the Crimson Fist compound. The news seemed to have had a great effect on the Grey Monk, and though he did not say it to her, Cheryl knew he was making preparations to leave. Whether to search for Sunday across the realms or to figure out what direction his life should lead, it was unclear. Her friend would not stay in Daring anymore. And without a word, one day, he was gone. The days grew longer and hotter. Astra was by Cheryl's side, helping at the Order's headquarters. On such a day, the sun high in the summer sky, the winged unicorn was by the stables, quenching her thirst in the midday sun. Varys was just returning from whatever errands he had needed to run that day, riding in on Tuval, when she stopped drinking, lifted her head, and turned her starlight gaze to the stag. "There will be another load of items to take to the refuge in a little bit, Astra, if you're up for it," Cheryl had asked through their bond. There was no reply. "Astra? If you're ignoring me so you won't have to carry anything, then..." Cheryl stepped around the corner and she felt like she had walked in on a private conversation. There was a poignant energy in the air that made the hairs on her arms stand on end. But she couldn't see what Astra was looking at. Stepping out farther, Cheryl was surprised to see Tuavel, still as the deep woods, only his nostrils flaring as he breathed in, eyes locked on Astra. Astra? Her friend does not acknowledge her, continuing to stare at Tuval, her spiraling horn softly glowing. Cheryl had never seen it do that before. She looked back and forth between the two, unsure what to do, as the air between them only seemed to grow more electrifying. What is going on? Cheryl hears Varys' deep voice, and like the snapping of a twig underfoot, the spell is broken. The mighty stag turns and follows the Grand Master, disappearing from sight.
What was that?
Cheryl asked after a moment. Astra takes a deep breath, shaking her head, her moonstone-colored mane shimmering in the sun's light. A greeting, she replies cryptically.
That was more than a greeting,
Cheryl says, her hands going to her hips, one eyebrow raised. I wasn't sure if you two were going to charge one another, or find a meadow in the forest and...
I do not judge you and your interactions with the Grand Master, Merla. Do not judge me and mine.
Cheryl is taken aback, affronted that Astra was offended at her teasing. But just as quickly, embarrassment creeps in, followed by guilt at what she had been implying.
Your forgiveness, Astra,
she says sincerely.
I should not have said such a crude thing to you. It was not my place to judge that which I do not understand.
Astra slowly blinks down at Cheryl before answering.
There is nothing to forgive. I was unprepared to meet one of the Kree Airgeed.
When Cheryl gives her a confused look, she explains.
A silver heart. They are rare, akin to legends to the Pegasus. I have heard stories of them, but to meet one here.
Cheryl smiles and steps up to Astra, laying a gentle hand on her face.
I hope it was a friendly hello.
It was not unpleasant.
The Fey Bard lets out a soft laugh.
Come, let us get the next load of items to the refuge. You can spend some time with the children whilst I unpack.
The two go over to where Bane has set up a decent-sized pile of items, and Cheryl starts packing them away in her handy satchel, the extra-dimensional space empty of her adventuring gear. She's about halfway through packing when a snippet of conversation between Gritz and Conrad catches her attention as they pass by.
Why does the new Squeak keep trying to steal food?
Conrad asks, confused.
I don't know,
Gritz grumbles.
Caught him trying to grab some moldy bread that had gone off on the solstice. Tried explaining that he doesn't have to do that. There's plenty of food to go around.
Cheryl stops dead. Over half her arm disappeared into one of the side pockets of her bag.
Oh no.
She looks at Astra, dread written across her face.
Astra, we've missed Saliasuli Varanel!
Saliasuli Varanel. The eternal summertime. Many things are unknown about the courts of the Feywild. The denizens of the land of wild magics are capricious, to the point of cruelty at times. But that does not mean they are without their traditions. One such tradition occurs at the height of the Summer Court's power, during the eternal summertime, Saliasuli Varanel, as it is called in the Sylvan tongue. One does not call this tradition a ceremony, because though there is a sense of formality to the event, there is no incense or prayers used. The Fae do not adhere to such strict and rigid lines like those of the mortal realms. Rather, it is an unspoken and intuitive magic that guides this ritual. It starts with a fae of the Court of Summer, masked, wearing the faces of any and all manner of creatures, arrayed in groups which to those not of the court would be hard to find commonality. The faces worn are meant to be a reflection of the growth gone through over the year prior, for whatever that may mean to each denizen of the court. Then the music and dancing commence. The steps themselves are not important. It is more of a weaving through space and, if anyone else has happened to be present when the fae dance, it has a power in itself that can cause time to fluctuate in unquantifiable ways. This dance can last for days or mere minutes. It is hard to observe the passing of time in the Feywild as a rule of thumb. However, as the creatures of the Summer Court dance and weave, they eventually pair off in duos, trios, or however many in a group seem appropriate to those who wish to do so. It is rare that there would be one lone fae at the end of this, but it has been known to happen. See the chapter titled Fae and Fate, the ties that bind the fair folk to the realms. As they retreat into the twilight woods for more private celebrations, the masks are taken off by the respective partner or partners. During all of this, the Queen of Summer observes her people, though not from her throne. She could be the hand that holds the dryad, or the arms that embrace the centaur. For her mask is more than the one worn on her face. It is the one she wraps around her in the very threads of the gown she wears. Normally, Queen Titania is unmistakable, but for this, the choosing, she has all the power, and her people are hers to select from. Should Titania choose to join the revelries, for not every year she does, it is because she wishes to choose the Marfashre, or the short-lived king, her Oberon. It is a common misconception that Oberon is an archfey who rules by Queen Titania's side in the Summer Court. This is not the case, and many a woe-begotten fey or mortal has made this mistake, which has cost them more than their lives in attempting to subdue or coerce the great Seelie Queen. To become the Oberon is one of the greatest honors the Queen of Summer can bestow on any of her court. But the Fae are capricious beings, and their interests can wane as fast as the moon cycles through her phases. There has been but a mere handful of times where a Fae has borne the title of Oberon more than once, and even fewer who keep the title past midsummer, a month and a half hence, when the Queen of Summer can choose to keep this bond through the year, or discard it like an old, moth-eaten coat. Many have tried to predict who will be the next Marfashre, but either because of the powers Queen Titania holds, or due to some other fated power, the Fae chosen is one that is never expected, but it has always been whomever or whatever the Queen of Summer wishes, without exception. Time in the Feywild is a funny thing. No one quite knows why time runs differently between the planes. Those realms which are closer to the material plane tend to keep to the same pace. But sometimes, oftentimes, either by magic, the change in a season, or through some weaving of fate, time slips, jumps, bolts, or pauses altogether. This can be a boon or a bane. One thing is certain. It is never easy to predict
when it will happen.
Merla thought she had missed the most important celebration of the summer court, Saliasuli Varanal, the eternal summertime. But our daughter of summer has had luck on her side on more than one occasion, and it seemed this was yet again another time where luck was in her favor.
When you came in, Murphy, all in a whirl of song and wind, I thought for sure the hordes of hell were on your wings.
Theno says to her. Her twig fingers pull on Merla's golden and peach-colored tresses, making her eyes water a little.
And since when did you have one of Lord Ecteirin's kin as your mount?
Her bark lips clicked together in that worrisome way they used to when Merla was a child, and it makes her smile a little at the memories the sound elicits.
Well, I leave you for a season, and you've changed into some court lady.
Astra is more than my mount, she is my friend, Theno. She and I have seen and done much together.
Oh, I heard, child. To think the small creature I helped raise is now leading one of our queen's greatest battalions on campaigns in Avernus.
Theno chitters, and Merla does her best to keep her expression neutral as the Fae pulls on her hair again, hard.
You will have more eyes on you now than you ever did before.
Is that why you came back? For Saliasuli Varanal? Merla asks, curious. What about your new family? Theno doesn't answer right away.
I chose to come back to see you, Murphy. The stories of your deeds have spread far in the Summerlands, and even a little beyond to those who choose to believe them. It would be remiss of me if I was not here to help you.
Merla's brow furrows and she turns to look at Theno. Though her voice is gentle, Merla's eyes are probing.
Surely your children need you more than I, Theno. I am capable of taking care of myself for the day to day. You do not need to be here like that, like before.
There is a nervous twitch to Theno's lips before she hides it behind a toothy smile.
Nonsense, dear art,
she says. Merla's insightful eyes tell her there is more behind her nursemaids being here. She just doesn't know what.
You need me. My young'uns have their father, and I can visit them when you're in the mortal realms. When you are here, I'm here.
She lays her hands on Merla's shoulders and makes her turn back around.
Let me finish getting you ready. The sun is nearly at her peak, and you must be present for the Mafashri.
She goes back to working on Merla's hair.
Maybe this'll be the year that Master of Revelries will finally man up. Wouldn't that be something?
Merla's heart skips a beat as a heat rises within her she was not expecting.
Master Croxrell is far too busy for the likes of me these days. I have not seen him since before Greengrass.
Aye? He and I were just speaking about you before your arrival, early this morning.
Theno remarks, puzzled. Though, he did disappear rather abruptly, without a word.
But he does tend to do that, la.
Theno notices Merla's silence.
I'm sure it's fine, dear. He's just got a lot to prepare today. You'll see him, I'm sure.
I would like that,
Merla utters quietly, the sylvan making her speak the truth in her heart. Theno rests a wooden hand on her sun-kissed shoulder, giving it a gentle squeeze. The tree-like Fae continues to chatter whilst she finishes getting Merla ready. For her part, Merla is deep in her mind, wandering from thought to desire, worry to want. She has purposefully not thought about Croxrell, because thinking about him hurts in a way her heart has never felt before. There is so much she wants to say to him, to try and explain. But would he even want to listen?
He somehow knew what I had done without me having to tell him. I understand why he would be upset. He was the one to teach me music, The one who's helped me find my song. Who guided me. Protected me when all other Fae tried to use me. I owe so much to him.
Her year in Cantus changed her. Opened her up to new possibilities. New inner strengths Merla did not know she had. Before, there would have been no way she would have mentioned anything about Sunday in front of her Queen Mother. And yet she had, boldly. She was not so naive to believe she was above consequence, but that's where her use of honest, persuasive words came in. She didn't have to rely on Cruxerill as much. She could finally stand on her own two feet as an equal, instead of master and student. Each journey back to Cantus was like going into the chrysalis, and each emergence revealed another vibrant layer of who she wanted to become.
I wish he could see that. I thought he could, that he would want this for me.
There. Theno grinned, one final dab of gold paint added to Merla's arms with a soft petal brush. The stout Fae steps back, and as she takes in Merla's appearance, she lets out a small breath of satisfied wonder.
Merla turns towards the looking glass in her chambers and hardly recognizes the person staring back at her. Hair braided and curled around the circlet she always wears, the powders on her face only highlight the features that have been gradually becoming more fae-like with each passing day. The fabric wrapped around her would be sheer were it not for the multiple layers draped over her body in soft creams and pastel daffodil yellows. It shimmers with every movement, every breath she takes, with varying sized pieces of copper, brass, and gold metals woven into its fine silky threads, which only make it sparkle even more whenever the sunlight hits her. The straps sitting on her shoulders look ready to fall off at the slightest touch, whilst the neckline dips wide and low enough to show off her collarbones, which seem more pronounced with the highlighting Theno has done on her body. It all comes together with a sunflower-like pattern at her waist, where it is cinched into a tight but comfortable corset, showing off a flattering, very curved figure.
Oh, Theno, I look...
You look like a vision of sunlight. Lady Merla,
Theno says, bowing. Merla smiles kindly at the Gruach, quickly stepping over to her and embracing her in a warm hug. Theno gives a little noise of surprise, not used to such affections, but she eventually relaxes, lightly patting Merla's back in the low-cut dress. Gently pushing out of Merla's embrace, Theno gives one last glance at her, and then quickly starts tidying up.
I'll leave you to do any final glamours, should you wish.
Theno says, and then departs.
Sure.
Is all Merla responds with as she looks at herself again. The asymmetrical high-low cut of the dress makes it very easy to move in. She spins around, watching the fabric float around her like an after-image. It elicits a delighted laugh, and she does it again, reflective rainbows dancing across the room. As much as she is enjoying herself, Merla knows she should finish getting ready. Going over to a small vanity built into the wall of her rooms, she picks up her mask, its half-butterfly form shimmering like her dress. Carefully putting it on so the braids and curls of her hair hide the ribbons holding it on, she looks at herself one final time in the mirror.
There's something missing.
Tilting her head, considering what glamours she could do, Merla tries a few, singing them into existence. None felt right to her, though, so she ends up dismissing them as quickly as she conjures them. She starts looking around her rooms, wondering if there was something else she could add. She had to have something, but what? Then she remembered the perfect glamour she could put on. That would be the final piece to her outfit.
Going over to her satchel, Merla reaches in and pulls out the cloak of many feathers she had received after the return from Avernus, from Arvel Morningdew. One would think with its myriad of dazzling, colorful feathers from birds unknown would make it weigh a lot, but it feels as light as air in her hands. Bringing it over to the looking glass, she tentatively drapes it over her shoulders. This is it! The way it fell to either side of the dress, leaving the low-cut back open to be seen, the ever-shifting colors of the feathers, it was the perfect final piece. Music drifted in through her large windows, and Merla knew the celebrations were about to begin. She was unsure how best to secure the cloak, when she noticed, tucked under the feathers, was the most elegant woven metal collar. Looking at it, she saw it could be adjusted to fit any outfit she chose. Excitement building within her, Merla places the cloak over her shoulders once more, adjusting the collar until it sat above the neckline of her dress. As Merla clipped the beautiful two-bird motif clasp into place, she felt something dig into her back between her shoulder blades, sharp and quick, like talons piercing her skin.
Ah! What the?
Quickly turning around, already second-guessing if she had felt anything at all, Merla tried to see if one of the feathers had maybe gotten loose. A stray feather could be what was stabbing her, surely, if anything even did scrape against her back. But she saw the feathers coming up and over her shoulders, cascaded in a waterfall of colors on either side of her middle back, sitting nowhere near where she thought she felt something stab her.
You're going to be late if you keep preening.
A blue-green fairy dragon stands, perched on the open window, platinum wings slowly folding in. The tiny creature sits on its hind legs and tilts its head curiously.
Lou!
Merla rushes over, sunlight making her glow as the feathers of her cloak shuffle and shift.
I was just about to head down. Would you care to join me?
Lumina lifts her snout up to smell the cloak briefly before answering.
Only if you promise to help me get the best sweets. The last time they were stolen from me.
She harumphs. Merla's laugh is bright, pure birdsong.
I will even help you get back at those pixies who stole your precious apple tart the last time.
Lumina's tail flicks side to side, a mischievous light to her eyes.
Then let's go! Follow me!
Not waiting for her, the fairy dragon leaps off from the windowsill, drifting on the wind to make her way down to the festivities beginning below.
Hey, wait! I can't!
Merla starts, but then stops as she hears words whispered into her mind.
Right, of course.
She mutters quietly to herself. Then,
wait for me!
Calling after the fairy dragon. Stepping up onto the window's ledge, she feels the wind pulling at her, tempting her to step out into its embrace. And she does so.
Lareth Ath, Aether!
Brilliant, radiant wings of every color imaginable shoot out, and instead of falling, Merla is flying, soaring, tumbling, and freewheeling through the air as she rides the air currents. Her laughter can be heard down below, and many of the Fae look up. Some smile at seeing the joy. Others give a more wary eye to the daughter of summer's descent. Days later, whispers in the court would have some Fae claiming Lady Merla's wings were black as midnight, and to look upon them would cause a shadowy dread to creep across their minds. Others would dismiss these claims, saying the Marfashrae went to their heads. They were merely dreading the waning of summer, now that Seliasuli Varanel had passed. As for Merla, she did not see Cruxeril at all during the Marfashrae. No excuses, no word, nothing. Plenty of people attested to seeing him there, but it was never where she was. She did not end up pairing off with another Fae either, which meant no one took off her mask that night. It was the first time she felt that maybe fate was trying to tell her something. Merla just wasn't sure what. This downtime write-up was called Saliasuli Varanal, set in the Cantus Expanse, a long-running 5th edition D&D campaign run by the London RPG community. Lumina was voiced by Rhianne Vardalion. Thank you for listening. Tune in again for the next chapter in Merla's story.